The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Very early on Sunday morning, but you shouldn't clap until I've finished. You may have changed your mind. You know, I think it's worth starting out just asking the question about why, why start with a discussion? Why have a discussion about a discussion and debate that took place at this point almost 100 years ago about the nature of imperialism? Why don't we just cut to the chase and have a discussion about the $1 trillion mineral deposits that they just found in Afghanistan, or what the U.S. is doing in Iraq? Or questions about the state of the workers' movement in Africa or China. Why don't we just jump to the chase and get into questions about what's happening now? And I think it's worth stepping back and just saying that, particularly in the U.S., but elsewhere, there's a real distrust of theoretical discussion and debate. Theoretical discussions kind of get divorced from what's seen as the more pressing issues of, like, what do we do, strategy, tactics, and, sometimes even scheduling. I mean, I'm sure people have been in activist meetings where it's like, there's never any time, there's never any time to have discussions about why is this happening? What's going on underneath, and what are the best strategies, even if they're long-term strategies, about how to fight it and end this system? We have to talk about what we're going to do tomorrow, flyering, what's going to happen immediately next. And theoretical discussions are seen at best as, somewhat academic and divorced from those more pressing questions. And I think we can also be honest, which is that divorced from the more immediate questions of what do, a lot of academic discussions are irrelevant and boring. But that's really a modern development within, within the left. Marx was certainly never one to create that divide. He certainly wrote Capital, which the first sentence of which is the wealth of those societies in which the capitalist mode of production prevails presents itself as an immense accumulation of commodities, its units being a single commodity, and our investigation must therefore begin with the analysis of commodity. A little boring. But he also wrote the Communist Manifesto, which begins, "A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism." Right? But there's a point that there's a relationship between the two. He spent years writing Capital, because only by going through the details of that system and understanding how capitalism worked could you distill it down to a slogan like, "Workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and the world to win." Those two things are related. And really, the time period we're talking about here was really an amazing flowering of Marxist debate. Really, a whole period where major theoretical contributions are made to Marxism. And one of the things I think is really, this may be a side note, but is worth noting, is that all of the major contributors to these debates are not divorced from struggle. They're all people who are rooted in the struggle of how to change the world and the practical building of organizations and parties to change the world, while at the same time having debates and discussions about a theoretical nature about the world that they're facing. And above all, to try to understand that world as a means to change it. And that's really the case with the discussions that we're going to look at today between Luxembourg, Bukharin, and Lenin on the nature of imperialism. These weren't academic debates. They were about how to understand a massively changing world. In 1913, when Luxembourg writes The Accumulation of Capital, Europe is on the verge of the First World War. The preceding period was one in which the great powers had carved up the globe into various colonial spheres of influence. And now Marxists were witnessing a series of proxy wars and very few people between major colonial imperial powers, and few people doubted that World War I was on the horizon. And the debates were really about how to understand the changes that had taken place within the capitalist world since Marx's death, and to understand them in order to change them and overthrow that order. So Luxembourg writes her book, The Accumulation of Capital, as really part of a twofold debate. The first is trying to understand the nature of imperialism, to try to understand what has brought the world to the brink of World War I. And the second debate that's taking place that it's also a part of is that she's vying within the German Social Democratic Party against those who are, quote-unquote, revising Marx, trying to prove that capitalism has overcome the contradictions that Marx talked about and that those earlier contradictions are no longer... are no longer relevant, and that it's possible to peacefully reform the system. And Luxembourg is very obviously firmly on the side of those arguing that capitalism is unsustainable and that a revolutionary transformation of society is necessary, not only to end exploitation, but to end a world that is plagued by reoccurring wars of more devastating and barbaric nature. And her discussion of imperialism is partly a contribution to that debate as well. But to go into Luxembourg's arguments that she makes about the nature of imperialism and where it's rooted, we have to take a little bit of a detour, and this is where we go into Greece. If everyone didn't get the handout, I think there's still a few more. Because much of Luxembourg's argument really start with a critique of Volume 2 of Marx's Capital. And so I have to backtrack just a little bit, and I'm going to try to do a very brief explanation of what she's talking about in Marx, and then we'll talk about what she says about it. Now, kind of a word of warning, Capital can be a little daunting. Actually, it'll probably be easier if you don't look at the equations quite yet. It won't be as scary. You know, capitalism can be a little daunting because the concepts it's the concepts it's describing are particularly, I think, difficult to understand, but Marx presents them in a way that we're not particularly used to, which is we're used to people laying out a whole bunch of evidence and saying, ha-ha, here's my conclusion based on all of this evidence. You know, from what I've shown you, clearly this is the case. And Marx sort of starts with the opposite. He starts with a bunch of statements that initially he offers almost no proof for. The fundamental feature of capitalism is the commodity. Labor is the source of all value. And then spends hundreds of pages drawing out those statements and offering a more and more complex picture of what that means. And the problem is, and I know this was the case when I first read Capital, is that it's easy when you're reading some of his more abstract descriptions of how capitalism works to try to make an immediate one-to-one correlation, say, okay, this explains how capitalism actually works and how I see it working around me. And the whole point of Marx is that capitalism... you can't look at capitalism that way, because actually capitalism obscures the way it works. And so the way you initially think, you know, what you see happens around you isn't really what's happening underneath the surface, and you're trying to get underneath the surface to see the real dynamics of it. And I say all that partly just it's useful in reading Capital, but I think it also comes back to some criticisms of Luxembourg that I'll get to in a second. But where is that little sheet? It'll help me. Oh, it's okay. So anyway, Marx really starts by trying to understand a simple formula, MCM prime at the top, which is from the standpoint, you know, that capitalists start with money. They turn it into stuff, commodities, which they then sell and get back more money, more money than they started with. They end up with a profit. And from the standpoint of capital as a whole, it doesn't really matter what they make as long as they make money off of it. There's a famous quote from U.S. Steel where they distributed a shareholders brochure where they said U.S. Steel is in the business of making money, not steel. And that sums up capitalist position quite well. But it presents sort of an enigma. Like, how is it that you take a bunch of money, turn it into commodities, and then magically you end up with more money than you started. And really, Marx's contribution is breaking down what happens in that commodity stage. And he says, if you want to look at the value of that commodity, you can break it down into three parts. And I'm running through this rather schematically. I encourage people to get Hadassah's talk on the introduction to capital from yesterday if you weren't able to go to it. But he says you can break that down into three parts, which is the second little equation here, C, V, and S. You have constant capital, which is the raw materials, the factories, all of the dead labor that goes into producing goods and commodities. Variable capital, which is the labor power that goes into it. And in particular, labor has the unique property of producing value itself, that they can get you to come in and work, pay you for 2 hours, they pay you for the day to come in and work, but you might make, let's say they pay you $100 for that day, you might make $100 worth of stuff. I mean, let's say you work in China in one of the Apple plants, you may make you don't even get paid $100 a day, you get paid $2 a day. Mm-hmm. You probably make $2 worth of iPads in the first 15 minutes you're at work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the day, you're producing iPads for Steve Jobs. And that extra part, Marx calls surplus value. And it's at the root of exploitation and capitalism, that workers only get back a small portion of the value that they produce. But the point for us in this discussion is really that while it doesn't matter from the standpoint of capitalists as a whole what they produce, they could make cars, they could make bombers, they could make nuclear missiles, they can make iPads, as long as it makes a buck, they don't care. But from the standpoint of individual capitalists, it matters a lot because they still have to sell their goods. They still have to find somebody to go out and purchase them so that they can get the money back, the M prime, and get their profit, and in Marx's terminology, so that they can realize the surplus value. And in trying to understand that process, Marx breaks it down into two. He tries to understand how that process happens, and he breaks it down into two ways of looking at it. He starts by looking at it as kind of simple system. He says, okay, what if you have a society that doesn't grow, that's simply about staying in the same place? And he says, well, if you look at this thing, he calls it simple reproduction. And he divides all of the goods in society into half, or into two parts. He says on one part, you have this thing called Department 1, which is all of the goods that get made, all of the means of production. So all the factories, the robotics, the technology, the machinery, all of that that gets produced in society. And on the other hand, you have the second department, which produces all of the means of consumption. So the food, the clothing, all the things that reproduce, that allow workers to feed themselves and clothe themselves and go back to work the next day. And he says, if you go through each round, he says, if you look at all of the goods that Department 1 produces, well, the next round, they can take their factories and machinery and cycle it back into the C part of the equation. Make sense? So they can recycle what they make back into their production process for the next round. The same thing, Department 2 can take the things that they make and cycle them back, and the workers and the capitalists within those within that department will consume it. But there has to be some exchange between the two. The machinery that gets made in Department 1 has to be traded with Department 2 so that they can put new machinery and new technology back into their process, and the means of consumption that Department 2 produces can go back into Department 1, and the workers and capitalists in that department can consume it. Everyone follow that? That's the basic thing that Luxembourg is going to talk about. He goes one step farther, and I'm going to kind of end with this with Marx and move on to Luxembourg. He says, okay, now we're going to talk about the thing about that doesn't really explain capitalism, because the whole nature of capitalism is that it's expanding. It's always growing. It's always trying to accumulate and find more profit and increase increase its production with each round. So what he does now is the section what he calls expanded reproduction, where he says, okay, you still have these two departments. You still have the constant capital, all the machinery and technology. You still have the variable capital. But now, the surplus, instead of being consumed completely by the capitalists, now we're going to break it up into three parts. Some of it's going to get consumed by the capitalists. Some of it's going to get brought back into production as new machinery, as additional machinery, new technology, more factories. And some of it's going to get brought back into the system as hiring additional workers. And through that, you begin to expand the system. And then he provides a whole bunch of mathematical examples that I won't torture you with about showing that that can happen. Now, it's worth saying, I just want to say here, that this is a very schematic example. And it's not meant to show how capitalism actually works in real life or in what you see around you, but to prove that this kind of equilibrium is possible. And he makes some basic points about the relationship between different departments. But Luxemburg's critique of him really starts, she makes a number of criticisms of his math and things that I'm not going to go into, because she states her point later in a book called The Anti-Critique, which she writes right after The Accumulation of Capital, which I think sums up her basic argument, but in a way that's a little bit easier to follow. She says, "Let us imagine that all goods produced in capitalist society are stacked up in a big pile someplace to be used by society as a whole. We'll then see, what we'll do is we'll look at how this mass of goods is naturally divided into several big portions of different kinds and destinations." She says, always in any form of society, production has to provide two things. First, it has to feed society, clothe it, and satisfy cultural needs through material goods. Okay, so this is the means of consumption that Marx talked about. Secondly, each form of production must replace used up raw materials, tools, factories, and so on to allow the continued existence of society and the provision of work. So now this is the means of production that are produced. And she says, so far everything has been provided for the money paid out by the capitalists, which is to say that everything is consumed. The capitalists put out the money, they pay for the means of production that get brought back in, they pay for their own consumption, and they pay the wages of the laborers, who then use those wages to go out and buy means of consumption. But she then says, but as you move into growth, as you move into expanded reproduction, now what happens? She says, in our assumed total stock of commodities in capitalist society, we must accordingly find a third person, which is destined. We must accordingly find a third portion, which is destined neither for the renewal of used means of production nor for the maintenance of workers and capitalists. It will be a portion of commodities which contains that invaluable part of the surplus that forms capital's real purpose of existence, the profit destined for capitalization and accumulation. So this is the part of what's produced by society that's going to be reinvested to expand production. And her question is, who buys it? Where does it come from? And she goes through a number of basically different classes in society and says, who can buy it? She said, the workers can't buy it. We've already covered them. They've already used all of their wages paid out by the capitalists to buy the means of consumption. It can't be the capitalists because they've used all of their money to buy new means of production and to buy their beluga caviar and furs for their loved ones and mansions and yachts. So they're tapped out. She also briefly says it can't be the petty bourgeois, it can't be the middle class, partly because Marx in this scheme assumes a society for simplicity of only workers and capitalists, but also because the middle class themselves don't produce value. Their wages are paid out by a portion of the surplus. So she says, there's no one, if you assume a closed society of just workers and capitalists, there's no one to buy this third portion. And she says, you can twist and turn as you wish, but so long as we retain the assumption that there are no other classes but capitalists and workers, then there's no way that the capitalists as a class can get rid of the surplus goods in order to change the surplus value into money and thus accumulate capital. So if you assume a world in which capitalism is a kind of closed system and we have only capitalists and workers, she argues that realization is impossible. The whole system would grind down to a halt because you have this extra portion of goods that no one's around to buy. And so what's necessary in her argument is to find a group outside of capitalism in order to provide for the realization of this surplus. And it's really the search for that outside market, that non-capitalist market, that that is the source of or the root of imperialism. That capitalism constantly needs to find markets outside of itself, and that can be sometimes within its own country, especially initially. Marx talks about this in the primitive accumulation of capital, and that you can, you know, throw people off their land and draw new parts of even within the country into the capitalist economy and into the capitalist market. But her main point is that this is also what drives capitalism to continually seek markets outside of itself and to expand across the globe. Is really at the heart of imperialism. And it's the struggle for the domination of these non-capitalist markets that's the driving force behind imperialism. She writes, capitalism expands because of its mutual relationship with non-capitalist strata and countries, accumulating at their expense and at the same time pushing them aside to take their place. The more capitalist countries participate in this hunting of accumulation areas, the rarer the non-capitalist place is still open to the expansion of capital become, and the tougher the competition. Its raids turn into a chain of economic and political catastrophes, wars, crises, and revolution. Now, I think there's a number of reasons to be... I mean, first to say, the strength of Luxembourg's argument is that she does root it in... She's attempting to root it in the nature of capitalism and argue against those that are arguing that capitalism's just a policy. And certainly that's an argument that continues to this day, that it's simply a policy of particular governments that could be changed if we change the government. And she's rooting it in the nature of capitalism and that some kind of revolutionary transformation is necessary if we want to change it. But I think there's a number of reasons to initially question her assumptions. First is that it totally upends Marx, which is that the dynamic of the system no longer becomes the exploitation of labor, but the plunder of the outside world. Now, upending Marx doesn't necessarily mean you're wrong, but it does, you know, it does mean you're making a pretty big statement that then needs to be proved, and I think we should be, you know, take note of it. The second is that I think if you accept her argument, she appears to have proven not only that capitalism is crisis-ridden, as Marx argued, but that capitalism itself as a system of production simply can't function. She's almost proved that capitalism can't work at all. And that one would expect that as non-capitalist sections of the world grew more and more scarce, capitalist growth would crawl to a stop, and ultimately the system would break down and collapse. And maybe you could argue maybe that wasn't possible to argue in Luxembourg's time, where there were still sections of the world that hadn't been fully integrated into the world system. But certainly today, you have to say that there's very little outside capitalism left. And I think the growth that's happened after World War II clearly disproves some of her central assumptions. And a bunch of people responded, including Bukharin. I'm not going to have time to fully go through their arguments, but basically what they argue is that, reciting Marx in this case, saying that it's really the continued expansion of the system that provides a market for its own surplus. So that it is the expansion of the system, the fact that in the next round of production, capitalists buy more factories and which employ more workers, that allows for the who then use their wages to buy additional means of consumption that allows for the continued expansion of the system. And the point being that simply to say that that equilibrium is possible doesn't mean that it always happens. In fact, capitalism is a chaotic system. And what Marx is simply trying to show is that that kind of equilibrium can happen, but then there's a whole series of factors that upset it. Continued competition between different capitalists. They're continually trying to produce more and more to seize larger shares of the market on behalf of their competitors. Falling rate of profit, which I don't have time to go into, but there's a constant drive to accumulate more and more and more that can drive the system towards overproduction. But it's not because capitalism can never realize its profits. And finally, I'll just say the last criticism I think to make of Luxemburg's understanding of imperialism is that it almost dehistoricizes it. It makes it something that has always been present in capitalism from the very beginning. And I think there's an insight there that I'll come back to, but that it doesn't actually explain what was clearly happening at the beginning of the 20th century, where clearly massive changes are happening. And the brink of World War I, clearly something has massively changed in capitalism, and Luxemburg's description doesn't really explain it. I'll just say briefly, a number of more recent authors have drawn on Luxemburg, have drawn on Luxemburg, particularly David Harvey, and sort of taken her insights and moved them forward and developed a theory about accumulation by dispossession. And he argues that really Luxemburg's insights were correct, and that there's been not only a continuing way in which capitalism has reproduced itself by plunder, by stealing wealth from outside itself, but he also argues that in more recent times that's now become the dominant form of accumulation in capital. And I will say, I don't have time to go into it, but I will say that I think there's a useful insight there about the primitive accumulation of capital being something that doesn't just happen at the earliest stages of capital, but that there is, in the way capitalism has developed historically, it has always used plunder and theft as a way of reproducing itself. And certainly from the slave trade, in Africa to more recently. But I think there's a number of weaknesses that also get brought over from Luxembourg, which is that, first, I think, if you see the world Luxembourg, if you see the world in the way Luxembourg writes, I think it leads you to... First, I think it leads you to seeing the main dynamism of the system being outside of the industrial world. That countries are constantly in crisis, constantly heading towards stagnation, and really misses that there has been real growth since World War II in those systems, and even in the global South. I think it's absolutely crucial to call attention to the kind of theft and plunder that has happened. But it's also the case that theft and plunder can happen at the same time as the continued expansion of the system, and that we have to be able to explain both the transfer of wealth from the South to the North that's happened, but at the same time you have to explain countries like Brazil and China and India, the fact that there has been real growth in those countries that's led to new changes in imperialism and in the balance of class forces around the world. And I think that theory of the accumulation of dispossession by dispossession doesn't really capture that. But I think if Luxembourg suffers from a tendency to overgeneralize, if we move to Lenin, I think Lenin's strength is really in his ability to take broad theoretical concepts and root them in a particular historical moment. He sets out at the beginning of imperialism saying that imperialism has emerged as the development and direct continuation of the fundamental characteristics of capitalism in general, but capitalism only became capitalist imperialism at a definite and very high stage of its development, when certain of its fundamental characteristics began to change into their opposites, when the feature of the epoch of transition from capitalism to a higher social system and economic system had taken shape. And what he's trying to say is that we have to start with kind of fundamental characteristics of capitalism, but then show how they develop historically and how they lead to new forms. And Lenin really starts, he lays out five features of imperialism. He says, if you want to understand what's happening, understand imperialism, there's five basic features. The concentration of production and capital has developed to such a high stage that it has created monopolies which play a decisive role in economic life. The merging of bank capital with industrial capital and the creation on the basis of this finance capital of a financial oligarchy. And I'll explain what these are, what he's talking about. Number three, the export of capital is distinguished from the export of commodities. The formation of international monopolist capitalist associations which share the world among themselves. And five, the territorial division of the world among the big capitalist powers. So what he's talking about is he starts by saying one of the changes that's taken place since Marx's death is something that Marx wrote about, which is the concentration and centralization of capital, which is that as capitalism develops with each round of crisis, some capitalisms go out of business as they compete with one another for the highest profit, drive others out of business, absorb others. You get larger and larger capitals. You can think you start with lots of car firms and you end up with three giant behemoths, General Motors, Ford, and what's the other one?
Chrysler.
Toyota.
Yeah. And as these firms grow, he makes an argument that also they begin to be tied in with the whole finance system, the banks, who start to lend money, and as they lend more money and finance more of capital investment, they also begin to run and have a power within that. And you begin to create the system of finance capital, which he takes from a German author, Hilferding, that forms a new kind of huge conglomerations of trusts and cartels fused with banks. And that those trusts and cartels then use the state to help divide up the world into their own economic markets. What's happened to that finance capital has divided up the world into its own little spheres of influence. And most importantly, he says, now the world has been divided up. Everyone has their own spheres of influence. At this point, the only way for various state capitals to continue to grow and is to do that at the expense of someone else and to re-carve up the world. And it's really that drive that's leading to the beginning of World War I. And I think, you know, some strengths of Lenin's argument is that first, he really locates the drive for imperial expansion in the inherent movement of capitalism. It's not a policy, but it's part of the inherent contradictions within the system. But that it also leads to new forms and new phases of capitalism. I think the difficulty with Lenin's book on imperialism is that it's a popular outline. He says it, and he provides more of a list of various things that are happening in capitalism rather than a fully fleshed out theory. So it's a little unclear what some of the relationships are between the various things that he notes. And there's some empirical things that I think have been proven that he was off on. The role of the banks was much stronger in Germany than it was in other countries. But there's a core to it that I think is still very relevant. And provides a terrific example of how and why imperialism has continued to persist across different democratic, republican, every major country has continued to persist, that it's rooted in the continual drive of capitalism to accumulate. And really, there's a lot of overlap between Lenin and Bukharin. Bukharin provides kind of more theoretical, more, I don't want to say abstract, but a more theoretical explanation of some of the things that Lenin's talking about as well. And he starts with a similar place, but says that there's two contradictory but united tendencies in capitalism. First is that it's continually trying to push and internationalize production. So there's the growth of international trade, and the whole first part of this book goes through, you know, the growth of trade around the world. But at the same time, you have what Marx and Lenin were talking about, the concentration and centralization of capital. So on the one hand, you have capitalism spreading internationally, and on the other hand, you have within various countries it combining and growing to these huge, these huge corporations. And in particular, Bukharin argues that as these corporations grow and combine, there's a process whereby they also begin to fuse with the state. And he goes through a number of reasons why this happens. First, that, you know, there's simply the question of personnel. I mean, you can look at the revolving door between, you know, Wall Street and Congress and Halliburton and Congress, and you can see the way in which there's just on a personal level there's sort of a fusion between business and the state. But I think much more importantly, that as capitalism, as these as these huge finance capital blocks compete internationally, they can also use the state to strengthen their position internationally. They can create tariff barriers and price controls. They can use the state to carve up spheres of influence that give them preferential treatment within certain areas. And finally, as capitals grow in size, there's a tendency for the interests of these huge capitals and the state to become closer. I mean, you just think about it becomes such a size that the strength of the U.S. state is partly determined by the strength of companies like GM. I mean, the old saying, "What's good for GM is good for America." And so he writes, there's a process by which you have the formation of what he calls state capitalist blocks. He writes, the result is the creation of a set of national blocks of capital set in the context of a world economy. Various spheres of the concentration and organization process stimulate each other, creating a very strong tendency towards transforming the entire national economy into a combined enterprise on the tutelage of financial kinds and the capitalist state. So that what you have are these huge blocks, and he goes, I think, too far there in how far that process goes, but in arguing that what you have is a number of competing state capitalisms trying to compete for an international market. And so you begin to have, even though as the amount of competition within a country has been reduced, is that you no longer have competition between, you know, hundreds or thousands of small capitals. You now have these massive conglomerates, but now that competition is reproduced on an international scale. So now you have giant state capital blocks vying for an international market. And they use economic means to do that. They use political means to do that, but increasingly they also use the armed power of the state to open up markets, to take markets from other competing countries, to back up their own strength. And I think I'll just wrap up, because I know I'm running out of time, is I think that really the strengths of this theory are a fewfold. Is that, first of all, you know, as we said before, it helps explain why capitalism or imperialism isn't simply a policy of particular governments. That, in fact, each government that comes into power, whether it be Democrat, Republican, Social Democrat, finds itself forced to, if it's committed to the extension of capitalism, to continuing its expansion internationally and continuing to pursue in imperial projects. I think it also helps explain, especially for I think in more recent times, it helps explain a way of understanding imperialism that's not reduced to simply the kind of to no blood for oil, which I think is a really good slogan. Again, I mean, it boils certain things down about the war in the Gulf, about why should we lose our blood for their money, right? But it also doesn't capture that it's not always, I think there's a kind of common sense understanding of imperialism when you talk to people that's about, oh, well, imperialism's about raw materials and cheap labor. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true. And I think, you know, Bukharin and Lenin explain that as a dynamic of imperialism. Yes, if you can find cheap labor, if you can find cheap raw materials, you can increase your profits. That is absolutely a part of it. But that's not the only part of it. It helps explain things like Bosnia, where there wasn't $1 trillion of lithium, you know, under the ground. Like, how do we explain that? That it's also about powers competing for political geostrategic position. You know, that it can be about the U.S. rehabilitating its military. I think in the case of Bosnia after the defeat in Vietnam, it can also be about the U.S. getting a foothold in a region that used to be the territory of a former empire in the Soviet Union, beginning to push its power eastward into Eastern Europe. And it also helps deepen our understanding of something like Iraq, which certainly is about the seizure of oil and the knowledge that there's massive oil profits in Iraq. But it's also about more than that, which is, it's also about making sure that nobody else controls the region, which is knowing that there are other competing powers out there. China is becoming a rising power, you know, and control of natural resources, control of oil is going to be a crucial part of the future of development of these powers, and the U.S. wants to make sure that no other power has access to oil without its say-so under its terms. I think it's also useful in that it explains imperialism as a world system, not simply a collection of discrete policies. And then, you know, there's certainly debates inside the anti-war movement about, you know, we shouldn't take up Palestine when we're talking about issues of Iraq, or we shouldn't take up issues of Afghanistan when we're talking about Iraq. And I think the usefulness of the Marxist theory of imperialism is also that it shows that from the standpoint of capitalism, these policies are interconnected. In the case of the U.S., they're about securing and maintaining its power and influence in the Middle East, and that they see them as all connected, and we have to fight for an anti-war movement that also sees those connections. And finally, you know, I think it shows twofold. One, that because this isn't simply a policy, because it's rooted in the way capitalism is organized, that a revolutionary transformation of society is necessary if you want a world without war, that we need to end the system that's based on accumulation and competition for profit if we want to live in a world without war. And it locates a force in society for doing that. That it's certainly, imperialism is both about the oppression of other countries by imperial countries, but it also locates the class dynamics, the exploitation of workers both here and in those countries, and the power of the working class and the interests of the working class in both countries in uniting and building a struggle to overthrow capitalism and end the society based on war and violence. And so really, I think our task is to try to take these ideas and take the legacy of the Marxist tradition and the debates and the history of trying to understand how the system works and how it can be overthrown, and relate that to the concrete questions facing our movement of how do we rebuild the anti-war movement, how do we connect up the issues of Palestine with Iraq, how do we reach out to Arabs and Muslims and take on the issue of anti-Muslim racism in this country, and combine that with a vision of a different type of world that we can fight for, in which we no longer have to each generation fight its own anti-war movements.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.